Hello and welcome to The Exit presented by Flippa. This is a 30-minute podcast featuring amazing entrepreneurs who have been there and they have done it. We talk to operators who have bought and sold businesses of all different sizes. You'll learn how they did it, why they did it, and get exposure to the world of exits through their story. And it is a world occupied by a small few, but accessible to many. And on this episode, I sit down with Sam Marks. But before we get into the episode with Sam, be sure to go through and listen to my episode with Josh previously. A lot of really great information there about, you know, the timeframes around jumping from venture to venture and just serial entrepreneurship as a whole. But on this episode, I sit down with Sam Marks and we talk a lot about his previous company, SkySigs, that was acquired a few years back by a company called Laura Lord. And it is a really pretty powerful brand and it was acquired in October 2013. So a lot to get through here. And it's a really fascinating conversation because he talks about the story leading up to it and then afterwards about how the acquisition took place. And it's pretty awesome. It is through, you know, he went to his manufacturer, he gets the email of the CEO of this company, reaches out to them, they get acquired by Laura Lord, and it's almost like a waiting game after that. And then they get people to bid together. Really fantastic story. They work with an iBanker, and I really find it fascinating of you learning how these acquisitions take place. And he's also the host of a podcast called Invest Like a Boss that's fantastic. I've had a chance to listen to it, and he talks a lot about entrepreneurs not having consistent income. It comes in tranches, so you really need to know how to invest that. So it covers a ton. So the links to all that will be in the show notes. But without further ado, let's dive into my interview with Sam Marks, the founder and CEO of Coworker, as well as the show host of Invest Like a Boss podcast. All right. I am here with Sam Marks, the entrepreneur and talk show host of Invest Like a Boss. How's it going today, Sam?
Steve's going great. Talking to you from the other side of the world, but you are currently in Tampa, which is an old hometown of mine and seems like a nice place to be this time of year.
Most definitely. It was so fun right before we started recording. We were talking about some of the cool hotspots in Tampa. And where are you right now? Because it's dark there and it's morning here.
I'm actually in quarantine, 14-day quarantine in a hotel in Bangkok.
Okay. Wow. Wow. So literally on the other side of the world.
That's literally, it's actually Tampa to Bangkok is just, the furthest you can fly in the world. You really can't, because I know when I used to live in Tampa and I would fly back and forth to Asia quite a bit, it wouldn't matter if you flew east or west. It's still the same amount of flying hours to get to basically, you know, Southeast Asia. So it's a stretch.
Well, let's kick things off with some background. I think I really like laying the foundation for all the listeners out there that, you know, want to know a little bit about how you got started, and, you know, your first kind of, I guess we could call it the first venture that you really found some success in.
Yeah, I guess I have what I would call somewhat of a classical entrepreneur story. I ran into some challenging times when I was at Florida State University. And by challenging, I mean, I was partying too hard and having too much fun, and the FSU PD disagreed with my actions. And by the time I was a sophomore in college, I had 4 misdemeanors. And by the time I was a junior, I had 4 misdemeanors and a felony, totally nonviolent crime. hosting a boxing match at our fraternity house. And there was a new law that was passed. And basically they charged me with a felony for hosting an unsanctioned boxing event. Wow. So I had all that going for me by the time I was a junior, and I decided, well, I'm not going to get hired out of college. So what are my options? I'm gonna have to start a business or I'm going to military or something like that. So I'd always been kind of the kid that was writing down ideas ever since I was like 10 years old, you know, writing down ideas in a notepad. Well, maybe I can invent a robotic vacuum cleaner or something like this to help my mom out and things like this. And I had this notebook that I kind of took to college with me, and through college, I was always writing down ideas. So I decided when I was a junior, it was about time to start an idea, because, you know, I don't want to go home, live with my parents and mow lawns for the next 10 years. So I ended up starting a website then that was called The Greek Faces. And it was just a couple of years after Facebook had really started and kind of started to scale across colleges in the USA. And my idea was, well, take that concept, but go even further niche on it and just create a platform for fraternities and sororities to you know, host events and meet each other and stuff like that. So that was my first entrepreneurial venture. It actually was grew really quick, and I had no idea what I was sitting on. I didn't know how to measure traffic or understand, you know, what scale meant at that point. I was only, you know, 19 years old, 20 years old, and the internet was so new. So when I was a senior, we ended up, someone basically called me up off my monster.com job listing, and I put it on there, and they just called me up, and a day later they're like, we like what you built, we're actually thinking of hiring you, but is this site still operating? I'm like, or they're like, do you still own this website? I'm like, yeah. They're like, well, maybe we could buy it off you. Mm-hmm. And literally the next day they offered to buy it off me for, you know, not an insignificant amount of money. And a week later I sold it to them, and I started working for them full time as a senior in college from my fraternity house. It was amazing.
Nice. Nice. So senior in college, you technically exit your first company, and then the bug is hooked. You're hooked into the world of building.
Oh yeah. It was addicting. And I was getting like a $4,000 a month paycheck when I was a senior in college. And this company was so far behind on what they were trying to build that I kept trying to work. And they're like, hey, just, you know, we'll come back to you when we need to get stuff done. So I was like, you know, senior in college getting a $4,000. I was used to living off noodles. Mm-hmm. I was living off like a $600 a month budget. And so when this came in, it was like, you know, I was partying all the time, thinking I'm the hottest thing. But yeah, that was my first exit. And, that certainly watered the seeds in me for entrepreneurship for the rest of my life so far.
Nice. Nice. So that was the education, basically, in a nutshell. You know, you had the social life at school, you got your education through business by building out Greek Faces, and then this acquisition happens, and you go there for a certain amount of time, let's say, and you're getting $4,000 a month. What brings you to start the SkySig company, and how did that happen? How did that take off? Hey guys, Steve here, and taking a quick pause from the interview. I know that selling a business can feel unattainable and just out of reach for everybody, but it's definitely something that is very reachable for people that are listening to this podcast with Flippa. And I've mentioned that this show is presented by Flippa. They have over 3 million users on their platform who are looking to acquire everything from content sites to e-commerce stores to SaaS platforms or even mobile applications. So if you're curious and want to know more about what your business is worth, head to flippa.com/theexit for free valuations on your business. It takes a couple minutes to literally go through, and you can just go through the whole process without committing to anything at all. So once again, flippa.com/theexit, check it out, get evaluation on your business without any commitments, and just see exactly what your valuation of your business is worth. So let's dive into the interview.
So the acquiring company, I went and worked for about 5 months. I walked in one day, I thought everything was going incredibly good. I loved the job, I loved the role. And I walked in one day, said, we're shutting down. And I said, when? They said, today. Like, you know, I'm like, can I take my computer and desk chair? They're like, yeah, sure. So I took that stuff. It was gone. I got 2 weeks severance, and then it was back to figuring shit out again. And I ended up, you know, I started a few side hustles. I was doing like crazy work, like, you know, road construction and surveying stuff while I was trying to figure out what to start. Ended up joining a startup and working for that startup for 2 years down in Miami. And when I was about 2 years into it, I had stock options in the company, but I was starting to have to go in every single day and just wasn't digging, you know, going into an office every single day and giving up those years of my life working for somebody else. So I started doing affiliate marketing online and learning how to do really well in online marketing. And about the same time, I went out to a conference in Las Vegas. And at that point, we were pretty reputable for being big online marketers in health and diet space. And a manufacturer from China came up to me and knocked, showed me this little clunky e-cigarette and said, hey, you know, I make this, and would you be able to sell it? And I looked at it and I was like, this thing is, you know, I tried it, it's totally primitive piece of crap product. But I thought, wow, like if that had a better design and could become a little bit more realistic, maybe a little bit better flavor profile, there's the tobacco market right there, like this massive, massive $100 billion market. And, you know, that's ripe for disruption. So that was where we got the idea to start the e-cigarette company. And, you know, one day, one guy that I was doing affiliate marketing with just called me up and said, I think the time's now, like we're hearing things about this product starting to do really well in the USA. And we said, you know what? Why start in the USA? There's already people here. Let's go to the next best market. What's the next best market? I don't know. What's English speaking? Smokes cigarettes, has a tobacco ban. Cigarettes are expensive. How about the UK? You ever been to the UK? No, have you? No. Oh, well, let's give it a try. So that was the decision to start SkySig. And basically a week later, I booked a flight to London. I was 25 years old, and that became my home for the next 3 years.
Nice. Nice. And who did you initially bring on? Was it people that were from that startup in Miami? And how did you initially get that start? Did you raise any money, or did you, how did you assemble the crew, I guess you could call it?
Yeah. So I think a lot of the listeners will probably love this. I'll just fast forward a little bit in the story and come back to that, but we never raised any type of significant money. The total capital that we put into this business was about $250,000. And most of that money wasn't until later on, a few years down the road. So what we achieved off that money is really incredible, especially in that period of time. But I quit my job in Miami for the startup. I had stock options. My stock options in this company would have ended up being worth over $1 million if I'd stayed with the company for another 2 years. So I knew I was walking away from something meaningful, but I still wanted to take the risk. One of the guys I was doing affiliate marketing with, who was basically bankrolling the affiliate marketing operation, I was running all the ads and everything, and he was just giving me credit cards to run up a balance on and paying this off. You know, we decided to do the business together. He's like, I'll put in 50,000 and you run it. Same type of thing. We never thought this was a business that we were going to be able to exit. It was just too gray. And we thought we'd be killed by tobacco executives before this thing ever really got moving. But anyways, I flew over there, and that first 50,000, we spent about 5,000 building a website. We spent 20,000 making our first purchase order, getting all the branding done. And so we'd spent 25,000, and that first shipment of goods flew into London and met me off the plane. I rented a car, like a hatchback. I had to learn how to drive backwards and all that shit, you know, driving, yeah. Steering wheel on the right, yeah. Driving on the left. I'm 25. I don't know what I'm doing. And I put all the product in the back of the car, and, you know, we had a website, we had product, and you can't advertise. So I get there, and by the time we get there, I mean, all this is happening so fast, we realize you can't advertise e-cigarettes. You can't advertise. It's tobacco. It's labeled as tobacco. We're like, this is our strength. We're amazing online marketers. We've made a lot of money in doing affiliate marketing. And now we just realize we can't advertise. So how do you market a product that you can't advertise traditionally? And so we figured, okay, you're going to have to go past this, you know, these products out in the streets. So I just started going pub to pub to pub, putting on a fake phony British accent, going up to people and handing them product and asking them to try the product. And I started taking photos and videos and handing out promotion codes and stuff like this. So we couldn't advertise. So we had to do things a grassroots way, a traditional way. And we just started going pub to pub. Initially it was just me. And then I flew out a college friend, and we lived in the back of the car and hostels. And that was all we did all day. We go pub to pub to pub, handing out product, directing people who like the product to go onto the web and reorder refills for the e-cigarettes.
Love it. Love it. And I love the fact that listeners out there, have the opportunity to hear an authentic entrepreneurial journey that's not all, bright, shiny yeah. exits. It all starts with a grind of, literally sweat equity, where you're living out of your car and you're going pub to pub, talking to people, getting it in the hands of people, handing out promo codes. I love the hustle there. And that's a fantastic way to get it out word of mouth wise. You know, if you can't yeah. advertise via like the traditional channels, it's a tough thing to not be able to do.
Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. Well, that I always, when people ask me about this experience, I mean, I think the best part of this experience and advice I always give to people, I mean, if you're in your 20s, you're immortal. And to have that experience of going to a foreign country and trying to start up a business, win or fail, that whole journey was so exciting. Now that, it's stay in your home city where you're well-connected, raise a boatload of money, and try to scale as quick as possible, but, just blowing money on all types of advertising means, et cetera. But this experience of going to Britain when I was 25 and starting this and living in cars and, it was like an extension of college, but such a much, much better adventure all around. So I would just encourage anyone who's thinking about entrepreneurship and getting started. I mean, that can be such an amazing element mm-hmm. To your experience. Consider trying it in another country, because so many people would never take that route, but something that I really cherished and got a lot of value out of.
Yeah. And it's basically the comfort zone that people step out of to start a company, even in their hometown. It's taking it to the next level of like a double step
on steroids.
Out of, yeah. The step out of comfort zones on steroids, basically going to a foreign country to start up. So let's talk about the exit itself. Let's kind of deconstruct that a little bit for listeners in terms of how it happened. How did the initial conversations start? And how big were you guys when those conversations started?
Yeah. So this is a question that was always going through my mind when, as I was building this business and previous businesses, was like, how does an exit actually come about? Does someone just email you through the support queue one day? Does someone walk by your office and knock on the door? Do you go out to dinner and meet somebody that how do these things happen? Right. Because halfway through the business, we didn't have anyone inquiring about buying the business. But by that time, within 3 years of starting, of me landing in the UK, the business has been pretty significant. We're doing $2 million a month in revenues. We had started doing retail. So we were reinvesting the online profits into starting retail distribution. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it was really still fuzzy and gray, the e-cigarettes. We didn't know how governments were going to treat it. We know how it was going to be regulated. And it was super stressful, because every morning you would wake up and you don't know if you're going to be shut down the next day. And in the US, things were materializing much quicker. And you could tell tobacco was starting to get into the industry, whether by building or by acquiring. And there was a company in the US called Blucig, which was the biggest, and we had some inside information on them. So I thought that, maybe we can form some type of alliance and help each other out. So I ended up finding their manufacturer, and through their manufacturer in China, I got the CEO's kind of direct email on the hush hush. And then I just emailed the CEO and said, hey, we're the biggest in Britain. You're the biggest in the US. We're not planning to come to Britain. You're not planning to come. If you're not planning to come, I'm sorry, we're not planning to come to US anytime soon. If you're not planning to come to Britain, why don't we help each other out with data or insights or, whatever is working? We can share this data and support each other a little bit. And he responded basically saying, my first thought is that maybe you guys could start representing us in Britain. And my response was like, well, that sounds good, but we have an established business and brand that we've been working on for 3 years. So like all of our equity is tied up in that. So if you wanted us to work with you on that level, we'd have to think of it more as a merger and acquisition. And he said, let me get back to you in a month. Well, next week, news broke that they got acquired for $130 million by Lori Lora Tobacco. And then I didn't hear anything from them for a year. And during that year, you know, we were expanding our business. We knew now that tobacco was getting into it. So it was only a matter of time that either Lori Lora wants to expand further or some of these other companies want to get involved, these other big tobacco companies. But the writing was on the wall. Mm-hmm. So we just focused that year really on trying to put up barriers. We did some pretty interesting stuff. Like we moved our brand a little bit more towards the brand in the US. and then we filed design patents across Britain so that if they ever tried to import their product to Britain, they would basically hit a firewall. So we did some things like this, just be a little bit more protective. And then eventually they just emailed me back a year later and said, hey, you know, we're interested in expanding more. Would you guys want to have a conversation about possibly being acquired? And that's how it started. You know, Nice. That's how it started. With these things, I've found in my experience that having one company want to buy you is great. Having two is like 10 times better, because when you have two, you have competitive tension between those, and it just makes you that much more appealing and it gives you so much more leverage. So we ended up bringing on investment bankers to handle that process. And their first job was trying to go out and find another party would be interested in potentially buying us as well.
Got it. Yeah, because often there's a why. A lot of times, you know, first of all, people wonder, okay, how does an exit happen? And then people wonder, why does an exit happen? And many, many, many times people think that, you know, someone's burned out or, you know, they're just ready to move on to the next venture. And sometimes that is the case. But in this case, you guys had expanded and basically just, it was a land grab. You guys got control of the market. You were the leaders in the market. And then it was just a matter of time, basically, before these acquirers came out hunting you guys to effectively acquire you. So that's kind of baked into the why. But for people out there that, let's say they have been operating a business for the same amount of time you were operating SkySig, what would you say was the driver to really go through with the acquisition? Were you eager to start something else? Would you have continued to run it, do you think, if the acquisition wouldn't have happened? What was your kind of why you went through with it?
It was an extremely fun, but even more stressful and chaotic business to be part of. Even I was 28 when we ended up selling it. So we started this thing and we scaled it in 3 years. But every single day we woke up, we didn't know if we were going to be killed by some tobacco or big farm exec. And I mean, like, seriously, this was major concerns for us. We had all types of death threats that we just never even knew where they came from. It was really weird. I don't know if you ever heard of like British Airways, their dirty tricks that they played on Virgin Airlines, but it was the same type of stuff. For anyone that's familiar with that story, it's the same type of stuff. And it was really challenging. You couldn't raise money. There was no VC money available because it's gray area. So we're just operating it off fumes. And every morning you woke up, you didn't know if you're going to be shut down. And then on the other side of the equation, we had just seen a company that was very comparable to us get acquired for $130 million. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot more growth ahead of us. But at the same time, it was like, and if we could even get a fraction of that, I was 28 years old. Any type of money like that would be extremely, extremely life-changing. Now there's at this point, there's four partners in the business and we were all at different emotional levels. Like I was the single young kid that had two nickels to scratch together. Two of the other guys were going through divorces. They wanted money. One other guy just wanted to, you know, build this thing and become a billion-dollar business. And in hindsight, probably could have. Look at Juul, you know, and we were really the first big players in Europe. So I was pushing for just to exit. My attention span, true to millennials, is pretty short, you know, from where I live to who I date to what I work on. So I'd been in it 3-4 years. It felt like a lifetime to me, and I wanted to cash out and move on. And I think that was the right decision in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah. So the company goes through the acquisition. Lore Lord was the one who acquired you guys. What happened afterwards? Was there a vesting schedule? Did you have to stick around? A rebrand? What happened after the acquisition?
Oh man. And that whole acquisition process is such an incredibly interesting story that was full of ups and downs, but we ended up having two parties bidding on the company. One was Philip Morris, which everyone's probably familiar with, and one's Lore Lord, who people are less familiar with. It was a big U.S. Tobacco company, third biggest tobacco company in U.S. But Lore Lord ended up, winning the quote unquote bidding, and so we did the deal with them. Half the deal was cash up front, half the deal was in an earnout, and so basically both companies were bidding on different structures of the business. Philip Morris wanted the manufacturing. We had set up our own manufacturing in China. They wanted the manufacturing and they wanted the brand. Lore Lord didn't want the manufacturing. They just wanted the brand and the retail distribution. So basically we just agreed between the shareholders. Like I at that point was focusing more on the manufacturing, said whoever we do the deal with, whoever is important to that part of the business at the time will just stay on. That, they're going to get plush salaries and executive packages and stuff like this. So because we did the deal with Lore Lord, I was pretty much done about 6 months after. So I was already in Asia. I tidied up the manufacturing. I was done. Now the challenging bit of this whole thing is like immediately after doing the deal, we got into litigation with Lore Lord because of the way that certain things were accounted for. So that already like muddied the water post transaction. And then we had this really large earnout that we were going after. But the relationships were already kind of dinged at that point. Long story short, the earnout went for another 2.5 years, and we only got, I want to say we only got about 1/10 of what we were expecting in the earnout. And true to most earnouts, built, they are much more suited for the buyers than the sellers. They're an earnout for a reason. So, but all in all, a very good end to the story. We achieved a $100 million valuation off 250,000 total capital contributed, and we scaled it from zero to that in 3.5 years, starting out of the back of a car. So the whole ride was really incredible. And I think to date there's been like three e-cigarette companies that have been also acquired. But that when we got acquired, people were still, most of the world still unfamiliar with e-cigarettes, but now it's everyone sees it everywhere.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And like you said, Juul, I mean, really took it to a new levels for sure. And it's funny because I literally just sat down and watched Thank You for Smoking last night, which is so funny that we would we'd be sitting down to talk after after watching that movie with like the slick lobbyist for big tobacco. But after the acquisition goes through, sounds like the earnout, it was a little bit bumpy, which a lot of earnouts, majority are quite bumpy, in my experience at least. What happens next? You start a podcast, you start a company called Coworkers. What are you working on now?
Yeah, so after we exited, I stayed in Asia for a while and tried to figure out what to do with my time. And that was one of the big learning experiences, was that there was so much buildup and anticipation and achieving the exit. And then the exit happened. It was sort of unclimactic. And I immediately was like, what do I do? Like, what do I do all day? I'm 28. All my buddies are working. And I had this company that was, we were basically up to 100 staff in the UK, and our manufacturing arm in China was 400 people. And I was just used to all this stimulation and activity all day long. And then the light switch went off and I was like, what do I do? Ended up, frequenting lounges and bars way too often. And, just decided I had to, you know, had to kind of refocus all my attention, and I loved entrepreneurship. So from that point, I overdid it. I went, you know, I started investing in a lot of startups, which has been good experiences. And then I started a couple of companies, including this current one I have, Coworker, and started a podcast, Invest Like a Boss, because I figured, got to figure out how to manage my own money. Because I was tired of the vulnerabilities of speaking to financial advisors and feel like I'm getting pushed around and all this marketing lingo that I can't understand. And yet I look at my account and what they're telling me doesn't seem to, the words don't match the music. So I started to invest like a boss, and that is honestly probably been the best thing I've ever started from a position of empowering me to feel like I am not going to get screwed over financially by the system or by advisors or by government or whatever. And I think, you know, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to make money in tranches. Your earnings are going to be anything but consistent. Mm-hmm. And when you make that tranche of money, you need to know what to do with it. And that's been basically my mission over the last 4 or 5 years, learning it for myself and sharing that journey with the listeners.
Well said. Well said. I love that. It's earned in tranches, anything but consistent. So you got to learn what to do with it when you have it, when the ups are the ups, right? Very yeah. Well said. So the finale question that we ask everybody on the show here is, knowing what you know now, what would you tell Sam 10 years ago?
Sounds sort of boring, but I wouldn't do anything different, because my 20s were just, I couldn't have wrote it any better. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have wrote it any better. And I think that even if I hadn't had that exit, I don't think I would have changed anything, because the experience of doing what was done, that whole journey was incredible. Like I was, well, up to the point of exiting, I was like, if this exit doesn't go through, the business will probably fail. If it probably fails, I'll probably just go like to South America or Southeast Asia and like get a job as a taxi driver or something until I figure out what to do. Because I was just enjoying the experience of like foreign adventure and foreign conquest so much. But I have to say, like, that experience at SkySig was extremely spoiling. And it's never, from seeing what I've learned after, you know, I exited that company, I thought, I've got this system cracked. It's going to be so easy to make money going forward. I'm going to build companies and scale them to $100 million in 3 years. And it hasn't been my experience. You know, what we did off that much money is sort of a fluke. And there was a lot of luck involved. So I wouldn't do anything different. I wouldn't have rushed into so much stuff post exit. I would have taken more time and just chilled out, read some books on like Buddhism or, you know, yoga, relaxation, because I got myself into a really weird spot after the exit, just, you know, trying to figure out, trying to find myself. But it was all a lot to take in at kind of age 28, I suppose, looking back. And then I would have slowed down. I wouldn't have overextended myself into so many different things, you know, podcast, 2 new companies, 10 startup investments, travel, all this stuff. Like it was too much. And you forget, when you start things, they're easy to begin with, and then they all grow up. You know, they grow up and become big, 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 big things that you either got to somehow support and maintain and grow, or you got to shut them down or you know, go sideways for a long time. So you always have to remember that what you plant these seeds, these things grow up, and you don't want to get into a spot where I got to, where just way overextended, stressed out every day and, you know, regretting some of those decisions.
Well said. Well said. Well, cool. Those are all the questions that I have for you today. Where can people go and follow your journey? Where can they go and listen to your podcast? Where'd you like to send people?
Yeah, I appreciate that. If you guys are interested in learning how to invest yourself, this is obviously a really interesting time with asset prices as high as they are, and these, Bitcoin and Tesla. But what we try to do is really just take a do-it-yourself approach and just empower you with knowledge to learn how to manage your own money instead of using advisors. Anyways, it's called Invest Like a Boss. We usually do an episode a week and just interview experts, and then we talk about it and we share our portfolios on where we're investing and how that journey's been. So if you want to check it out, investlikeaboss.com.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, all the links that Sam mentioned will be in the show notes. So definitely if you're listening on Spotify or iTunes, definitely check that out. But thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing the exit and the story, Sam.
Steve, thank you guys. And I appreciate you guys dissecting how exits come about, because it can be really, can be daunting getting into entrepreneurship, not knowing how you can get out. And I think this is a big question that people need more transparency on and more assurance on the different routes that you can take to achieve an exit. So thank you guys.
For sure. Thanks for coming on.